So today we're gonna do hopefully several things. At the very least, I'm gonna end up introducing POVMs, which you need for the tutorial on Thursday, whether we'll have time to have the full discussion about the problem of the measurement problem or not, or we'll have to continue Friday. That is to be seen. But let's finish the section on entanglement measures with a couple things. Number one thing is the notion of mutual information, which is very interesting. The notion of mutual information comes from information theory. And it's basically a measure of the, if you want, the ignorance that you remove about probability distribution Y when you are given a bit, for example, about probability distribution X. So I know something about someone, and by knowing something about someone, I know something about someone else. You just think, I don't know, two twins or something like that. If you learn the information about the color of the eyes of one of them, you have gained information about the color of the eyes of the other because they are correlated. So mutual information is a measure of correlations. Make sense? Everybody? It's not a measure of entanglement. Well, this is actually a classical probability distribution, so we'll talk about the quantum version of it. But first of all, it's a measure of correlations. Agreed? Between two random variables. Now, there are two definitions of mutual information that are equivalent. Definition number one is this one. Though both are really easy to interpret from the point of view of interpreting the meaning of mutual information. Number one is, well, take the Shannon entropy of distribution X, add it to the Shannon entropy of distribution Y. This is the total ignorance of the marginals, right? The marginal distributions, X and Y, and subtract the ignorance that you have in the full distribution. If they're not correlated, then you know that the ignorance in the marginal and the ignorance in the marginal of X and the marginal of Y is gonna be the same as the ignorance in the whole distribution because there's no correlation. Make sense? However, if they're correlated, when you know one of them and when you don't know one of them, and well, you have ignorance on one and ignorance on the other, and you subtract the ignorance in the total one, there's something finite. There's more ignorance if you only know the marginals because they are correlated. Make sense? There's an equivalent definition, which is symmetric, by the way. You can swap X and Y here, and it would be the same. One-to-one definition, which is this, is the ignorance in one of them, if you want, or let's say Y, distribution Y, minus the conditional entropy, the conditional Shannon entropy of Y conditioned to X. So what does that mean? The conditional entropy of Y conditioned to X, if you want, you can call it, it's a conditional entropy, is defined as this. So very easy, is the Shannon entropy, it's kind of a Shannon entropy, and you weight with the probability of the joint distribution, the log of the probability of, Y conditioned to X, actually. Condition to X. Right, so this is the ignorance that you have on Y when you condition to a known outcome of X. The average surprise, if you want, that you get when you get, when you are about the distribution of Y conditioned to having a value of X. For example, I don't know, what is the probability distribution of you having brown eyes if someone else has green eyes? Make sense? These two definitions are fully equivalent, and it makes sense, right? Again, I have some ignorance, then I subtract ignorance condition to some value. If there's no correlations, I don't care if it's conditioned to some value, it's gonna be the same ignorance. Make sense? If there are correlations, then it's not going to be, if there are no correlations, these two things are exactly the same because I don't care. The average surprise condition to values of X, I don't care, it's gonna be the same. X is completely uncorrelated. And if they are correlated, very strongly correlated, you all the ignorance of Y is exactly the same that you have when you condition it to X, right? So it makes sense. For example, in the case of full correlation, perhaps you have zero ignorance of about Y once you condition it to X. Make sense? Okay. So mutual information is a measure of correlations between two random variables. Now we can have quantum versions of it, of course. You can call it the quantum mutual info.
right?
And I defined a mutual information of some bipartite system rho AB in the same manner. So the von Neumann entropy of A plus the von Neumann entropy of B minus the von Neumann entropy of the total system, which is basically the same as this. It's the Shannon entropy of the distribution, marginal distribution over A, plus the Shannon entropy of the marginal distribution over B, minus the Shannon entropy of the original distribution, the bipartite distribution. Now you realize quickly, if you want, we can have that as a definition. You realize quickly that, when this is a pure state, this is an entanglement measure, because it's actually twice the entanglement entropy. Agreed? When the original state is pure, this is zero, this is the entropy of a pure state, and it's just twice the entanglement entropy. Agreed? If it's not a pure state, it is definitely not the entanglement entropy, and entanglement entropy is not a measure of entanglement to begin with for mixed states. So if you are in a mixed state, certainly you can have mutual information on zero without having entanglement. Because of course you can have correlated state, we said. When you have mixed states could be classically correlated as well. Separable states, for example, the one that I wrote with the two balls, with the colors, right, are indeed states that are non-entangled but can contain correlations. Make sense? The moment that you have a more than rank one separable state, you can have correlations. Make sense, everybody? So far, so good. So now a question came up at some point in the 2000s, and the question was, all right, there are two equivalent definitions for mutual information. There should be two equivalent definitions for the quantum mutual information, right? So what is the version, the quantum version of this? All right, so that's the question that came up. And people define this. JA of rho AB definition is the von Neumann entropy of subsystem B minus the conditional entropy rho A, rho B. Now, what is this conditional entropy? Well, let's take a look at what this was. Does this magnitude here assumes that I'm able to reveal information about X, right? And I want to know how much ignorance I have on Y after some information about X is revealed. In fact, on average, because that's what this is doing. You average with the joint distribution the probability of having Y conditioned to an outcome X. Make sense? What does that mean in the quantum world? That is not an easy question. Because in the quantum world, in order to obtain information about a subsystem, you need to measure the subsystem. And if you measure the subsystem, the conditional distribution about B depends on, about A, depends, or is B? Yeah, B conditioned to A, yeah, I copied it right. Depends on the state update after I measure. And that's a tricky issue that we're going to get into today, because that's measurement theory. That's how do I model state updates after a measurement in quantum mechanics. So this thing I define as the minimum over all possible measurements that you can make. Let me write it like that. Of rho B. Measurements over A, over rho B, Bij. Right. So what I am minimizing here is, all right, I'm minimizing over all possible partial states updated after measuring A with all possible measurements. And what am I left with on B? And I'm minimizing because I'm saying, well, of course, here you can fully determine it, but I want the measurement that makes the most of it. I want the full correlation. I want the measurement that informs me the most about that. Make sense? What people found is that two things. JB is not equal to JA, and neither of them are equal to I rho AB. All possible measurements that you can make on A.
But like a measurement also measures B.
That's right, that's why. This is the entropy of B. So by measuring on A, I'm going to change the entropy on B, but I want to minimize the entropy. Make sense? I want the measurement that reveals the most. Make sense, everybody? Well, actually, the least. No, it's the most because the minimum entropy. Sorry, my bad. Make sense, everyone? Now, again, it's definitely similar to this one. Is take the average surprise that you get after updating with the measurement on A. Make sense? Now, when people found this, it's like, well, actually, this definition is not symmetric to begin with. And second of all, it does not coincide with the mutual information. Well, this one does. Agreed? So people defined this measure. Or this quantity, rather. And this thing is called quantum discord. Okay, so quantum discord. Oh, the screen is gonna. Quantum discord is the difference between the definition of mutual information that comes from this definition of mutual information for probability distributions, and this other quantity that is supposed to be the analog or the analogous quantity to this one. Make sense? And that's an interesting quantity because people found that quantum discord, people would say, okay, sure, when the state is probably classical, then it should coincide. And in fact, for many states, they coincide. For example, for pure states that are not entangled, they coincide, the two definitions. So the first thing that you can measure, oh, right, so discord maybe could be a measure of entanglement of some kind, right? Because when I have classical correlations, the two coin, at least for pure states, you think, when you have classical correlations, the two coincides. In fact, you cannot have classical correlations for pure states. When you have no entanglement, when you have no correlations, the two coincide. When there's entanglement, the two are different. So, right, so discord may be a measure of entanglement or something like that.
Sorry, when you say coincide, when?
These two. Meaning discord is zero. So people thought, okay, what about mixed states? For non-pure states, you can have states that are not entangled and have non-zero discord. So there was a little discussion about what discord was. It's a kind of quantum correlation, people say, that are not fully captured by entanglement. For sure, if you're entangled, you have discord, by the way. But if then you can have discord without having entanglement. So people thought about this being a kind of quantum correlations that are not captured by entanglement. And there's some controversy, and there's been over the years, whether this is a resource for doing something that you cannot do classically. Some people have claimed yes. People have speedups of algorithms using discord. Then some other people claim no, still under discussion. If this is something, there are people who believe very strongly that this is not a resource that you can use for doing better than classical stuff. Some people think that it is. There are PRLs on both sides. All right, so I'll leave it at that. I'm not going to enter into the problem, but we're going to try to understand this a little bit better. Now I think I need the screen. I'm just talking to the gods, to the gods of the presentation. There you go. Thank you. I'm gonna show you my little contribution to the discussion on Discord, because for the others it's tougher to talk about because, you know, it's a controversial topic. But of that one I can, because I already signed my name on this. So this is a paper, when I catch this, page 4. There's a paper that I wrote with Achim, Eric Webster, and Eric Brown, the two Erics, those were students at the time, in 2013. Where we thought we found something super cool. And it was cool, but not super cool. turns out. We were trying to understand this chord as, don't look yet, I'm gonna explain. We're gonna try to understand this chord as the remnant that is left in a bipartite system when the system was entangled with something else that you can see in a genuine kind of way. There's one thing that I haven't mentioned. There's more things than bipartite entanglement, right? For example, you've seen the G8Z state, no? Maybe not. Let me write it here. If I write this state, it's a tripartite state, ABC. ABC, right? This is obviously an entangled state, no? Certainly non-separable. But if you trace out one of the subsystems, the other two are not entangled. There's no entanglement in any of the bipartitions in this state. All the bipartitions of this state are separable. However, the state is entangled. This is called genuinely tripartite entanglement. There are two kinds of tripartite entanglements for qubits. This is the G8Z1, this is the Bernier class as well. The Bernier class, when you trace one of the subsystems, you still have entanglement into. But this one, when you trace out one of the subsystems, you have no entanglement in any of the bipartitions. That makes sense? So all the measures of entanglement that I talked about before would fail dramatically with that state, obviously. They're designed for bipartite entanglement. But you can say, oh, maybe we can quantify the tripartite entanglement as pre-existing entanglement in the bipartitions. No, not really, not in that state. That state is genuinely tripartite. Make sense? The problem of multipartite entanglement is a complicated one. There are two classes that cannot be related by LOCC. One is the Bernier class for qubits. There are two classes, the Bernier class and the GHZ class. LOCC cannot relate the two. As you increase the number of, for several qubits, the number increases really fast. Exponential, factorial, I don't know, really fast. It's a number. People, I don't remember the numbers, but I think there are 4 classes for 3 and 18 for 4, and it goes really fast. The numbers, don't quote me on those numbers. That's off the top of my head, probably wrong. But the number of different kinds of entanglements in terms of multipartite entanglement grows fast, and it's a difficult problem. If it was difficult to talk about bipartite entanglement, imagine how difficult it would be to talk about multipartite entanglement. Make sense? So one thing that we thought is, right, when you have, because this chord is only different from entanglement when you have a mixed state, right? Then our idea was, what if this chord is the remnant in the partial system AB of genuinely tripartite entanglement that existed with another system C? So this chord could be the remnant, it's quantum, therefore should be the remnant of something that is not really that present classically. So maybe this chord is the remnant of higher partite entanglement in a bipartite system, we thought. Make sense? So we tried to explain it like that. And we found something interesting. For qubits, okay, we found this. This is for qubits. In order to have this chord, you see this is here the discord AB and here the discord BA. They're not symmetric, remember? So you can tell that to have non-zero discord, you have to have both bipartite entanglement and tripartite entanglement. So the discord between A and B here, you always, in order to have non-zero discord, you have to have entanglement between AC and also genuinely tripartite entanglement of the kind that we were discussing here. In order to have, you see, discord in both, you need this kind of bipartite entanglement as well. And in order to have discord in one, it's pretty symmetric. It's pretty cool. If this were true for everything, for every quantum system, we would have understood discord. Because discord would be the remnant, after tracing out system C, of that entanglement that pre-exists between A and B, right? So we found this is necessary and sufficient for qubits. And we were so hyped. But we also found that it's only sufficient for higher dimensions. So yeah, if you have that, you will have discord. But you can have discord still without this kind of structure. Very sad. I mean, it's cool still. For qubits, it's true. It's necessary and sufficient, but not true in general for higher dimensions. This is not, these diagrams are not related to dimension. But it only works. That is necessary and sufficient to have bipartite and tripartite entanglement. And so you see, A and B are never entangled with each other. A and B, you see, are never entangled with each other. This circle represents bipartite entanglement, the triangle, tripartite entanglement. A and B are never entangled with each other. However, A and B are discordant with each other, if you want, once when there is bipartite entanglement and tripartite entanglement between the other parties. So we could, if this is true, we could understand discord as the remnant of tripartite entanglement and bipartite entanglement with another system that you are not seeing. Make sense? No?
Discord for me was like, I was feeling that it should be related to the problems of measurement. Like, because you measure, you mess with something, that's why you lose information in the, like, in general.
But it may be because there's correlations, quantum correlations with something else. That's what I mean. You see? So, again, if this were true, we would have solved the problem of discord, meaning we understand what discord is. It's sadly not true, as in, like, it's not necessary and sufficient. It is for qubits. So for qubits, you can totally think of discord as the remnant of entanglement in a higher dimensional system, a higher partite system. It's not true for high dimensions, though, only sufficient. Make sense? Anyway, that's a little fun note, because that's something I can stand behind, if you want, in this whole debate about discord. Any questions about quantum discord? So, summary, what is quantum discord? It's a kind of quantum correlation that is not entanglement, that classically doesn't exist either. Where does quantum discord come from? Well, we don't know where quantum discord comes from, but we know that for qubits, it comes from entanglement with a third system that we are not seeing. Make sense?
What?
Say again? It's the state. It doesn't matter. So for this, I would tell you, ignore that for this lecture, but read the paper if you want. Alpha and beta tells you what states are we taking initially for these examples.
Why did you think that the discord should be the remnant entanglement?
Oh, the reason I suspected that, or we suspected that, because it's only present for mixed states and is not classical. So maybe it comes from entanglement in a hyperpartite system. You see, there's always a system that purifies my system. We're gonna see it right now.
So now you're saying this is true for if you have
three two-dimensional systems,
but if you have more,
this is sufficient, but not having this entanglement structure is sufficient, but not necessary.
So if this happens, if there is remnants, there's always
discord. Yes,
but the other way.
Correct. You can find discord without that. Therefore, it's not. You cannot say it comes from that. Make sense? Maybe it comes from higher partite entanglement with something else. We didn't look at that because that's a difficult problem. Make sense, everybody? Anyway, maybe something for you to investigate one day.
How can you have higher entanglements here? You can't, the maximum is 3.
So no, you can purify with 2 systems if you want.
No, I'm just saying A, B, and C can be entangled. Nothing more than that. You can't have...
No, but you could consider 4 systems and then entanglement structure between the 4 systems.
No, I'm just saying, at least for this case, that you have only 3.
Yeah.
So for this case, this has to be true, not just sufficient. It has to be sufficient and the only way.
I'm not sure I understand. No, if it's not, we've proven that it's not, actually, in this paper. Then we show that it's not for system of more dimensions than 2. This is solely sufficient, not necessarily insufficient.
Even for the 3 bipartite systems that you have here?
So yeah, I'm telling you that to have discord, you need to have both tripartite entanglement and bipartite entanglement.
Yeah, but is that, you're saying that's the, okay, so.
That is sufficient for higher dimensions, but not necessary. You can still have discord. For qubits, it's sufficient.
Oh, okay.
Right? Okay. Makes sense, everybody? If you have harmonic oscillators, that's not true. It's only sufficient. Make sense? Even Q-treats. I can't hear you. To what?
Accessible information.
In a way, But what is accessible information? No, it's a different maximization.
If we do a purification.
Yes.
Not
quite, right? Because that depends on how you measure. What are your POVMs for measurement? We will discuss that when we have POVMs. This is optimized over POVMs.
Yeah. But you can
extend the yeah. Not that I know of, it may be. Yeah. Here's the one thing that connects with it. I'm not going to remove the screen because we took a while for it to work. So if you don't mind, I'm going to work here until we get to measurements, then up, and then down if we have time, again. Oh, man, can you see that?
No.
Ah, perfect. Thank you. Oh, wow, okay. Hopefully, Stein-Sprint theorem. Any mixed state rho A can be purified by a state. I'm summarizing. This is a very hand-wavy version of Stein-Sprint theory, and I recommend you check it. You probably have seen it, and you will see it in foundations very likely. But let me state it in the hand-wavy way because it's very easy. Any mixed state rho A can be purified by state rho AB in a Hilbert space HAB so that the dimension of HAB is larger or equal than twice the dimension of HA. So what does that mean? That means that the way of thinking about ignorance, you can think of ignorance, let me add entangled, obviously. It's kind of obvious that it has to be entangled, because what does it mean purified? Purified means that rho A is equal to the trace over B of psi AB. Okay. So you can think of any mixed state, of any ensemble, if you want, of any ignorant state about quantum mechanics, as what is left from an entangled state between that system and something else that you can't see. Right? As long as the dimension of the total Hilbert space is more than twice the dimension of A. Make sense, everybody? So you can think of ignorance as coming from entanglement, always. Mathematically, you are always entitled to think of entanglement as mixedness. Sorry, mixedness as entanglement with something in a larger Hilbert space. Make sense? So this is a theorem. Meaning you can always, every time you have a density operator, any time that you have mixedness, every time that you have ignorance, I can give you an entangled state in a higher dimensional Hilbert space so that rho A is coming from it, from the fact that I'm tracing and doing the partial trace over the other subsystem. Make sense?
When you think about ignorance, does it more make sense to think about I or think about J?
S. Ignorance,
right.
Remember, is the Shannon entropy?
Yeah.
So in this case, the von Neumann entropy. Mixedness, when you have mixedness, you have ignorance. If you have zero mixedness, okay, this is very important. This is what we did in the first lectures. This is a state that you know exactly what it is. Agreed? This is a state that you don't know what it is. It's a classical probability distribution over states like that. Make sense? Where does it come from? Well, it comes from because you don't have information. It's classical ignorance, if you want. Classical ignorance about what state you're in. What I'm saying is that this classical ignorance, remember the two balls that I gave you, pick one, don't tell me the color. So if I have to describe the state of color of your ball, it would be this, right? Black and white ball, pick one. Don't show me. And I want to describe the color of your ball. How do I describe it? Well, clearly, that's going to be 1/2 black plus 1/2 white. 1/2 probability of being black. 1/2 probability of being white, because I have no clue. What this theorem tells you is that you can think of that ignorance of mine as actually the ball is entangled with something else in a higher dimension, so that the partial state is that. Mathematically, for now let's not interpret, mathematically, this is the result of partial tracing on a larger Hilbert space. Make sense?
Why was it 2 times the dimension of?
Because you cannot obtain a full mixed state rho A unless you have another Hilbert space that is equally the same dimension. So for example, you have a mixed state of a system of 10 levels. If it's entangled with a system of 2 levels, when you trace it out, you're not going to be able to obtain every single rho AB. Sometimes you will, but not always.
Wait, I can't see it.
You can't see it?
No.
If I give you a probability distribution over 10 different states,
yeah.
How can you write it as entangled with a two-dimensional system? At best, you're going to have a two-dimensional sector that is entangled on the other side, not a 10-dimensional one.
Oh.
Make sense? Make sense, everybody? The maximum entropy that you can have is the log of the dimension, which is 2. So you cannot, the maximum entropy, here's another argument. The maximum entropy that you can have on system A, say, is 10-dimensional. So it's log 10, right? The maximum entropy that you can have on the other is log 2. So because the entanglement entropy is symmetric and works for a pure state, all that you can do is mix states of entropy log 2, not log 10. You cannot arrive to that. So you need at least twice dimension. Make sense? Everybody? Now, this is what justifies, or well, gives the signal, if you want, to gives the inspiration, an entangled state, right? That's why. To the larger Hilbert space, the church of the larger Hilbert space, meaning all the mixedness in the universe is entanglement. The universe could be genuinely in a pure state, and the reason we see entanglement, we see ignorance, is because of entanglement. Thermality, you can think of thermality as entanglement. That's actually a really good example. Thermality, why are things in a thermal state? Well, because they are losing information to the environment by entangling themselves with the environment. Once they're entangled with the environment, what I say is mixed. Make sense? Everybody? That is actually a really cool thought, that you can always think of ignorance as entanglement. How cool is that? I don't know. Does it bother you? Better be. Even when I give you the black ball, that's entanglement with something. Mathematically, it's true. That's what I mean. Mathematically, you can find a fictitious pure state that is entangled with your system so that the partial state is that. What I'm telling you is that why not thinking that that's what's going on? That is the, because you can do it, maybe it's true.
Okay, when you said you're a believer of the church of
yeah. I believe that mixedness comes from entanglement, yeah.
Oh, so you're saying everything is entangled?
Yeah.
Okay.
You see, what is difficult, getting entangled with things is really easy. You know, I entangle myself with the world. Most interactions are entangling. Any bipartite interaction that you can think of, if you don't start in an eigenstate of the interaction Hamiltonian, it's likely to entangle you. If you have a free Hamiltonian that does not commute with the interaction Hamiltonian, it's likely to entangle you. So it's difficult to find non-entangling interactions in nature. Most interactions are entangling. Entangling. No, entangling. As in, like, you start from a separable state and you end up in a non-separable state. In open quantum systems, you model mixedness. Open quantum systems can only be, can always be dilated to a higher dimension closed quantum systems.
Sorry, yeah. I must have missed something. When you kick the board, why are you now in an inseparable state?
No. This interaction is entangling. That's what I mean. Imagine that I come without never having interacted with the board. Therefore, I'm in a separable state.
Oh,
never.
Okay.
And then I do that. Now I'm entangled with it. It may be difficult to believe, but most interactions entangled. Convince yourself. Just got the simplest interaction. Find yourself. Here's a Hamiltonian. I have a simple two-level system. I give you some energy gap with sigma z. Typically, I actually do this. Whatever. It's just to put zero energy at zero. And then this is the other system A. Same thing for system B. So this is a system that has two systems that have two levels. The ground state and an excited state. Agreed? Zero would be the ground state. It depends what eigenvalue you pick. With the usual convention of quantum info, one would be the ground state. Now you understand why. And zero would be the excited state with the usual convention in quantum info. Let me add an interaction Hamiltonian. Ta-da! If you start in the ground state of both, you end up entangled for any time evolution. So, trust me, most Hamiltonians that you can think of will entangle if you start in a separable state. In fact, interactions that are the choice of initial states and interactions that are not entangling are a zero measure set over the state of total interactions. And they're a hard measure, for example. So it is very easy to get entangled. And in fact, that's what you see. When you see something in a peer state, look in a lab, how difficult it's not entangling things. In a lab, that you need to cool down things, superconductors, they need to be cooled down, right? The moment that you're not really being careful with it being cooled down, the thing stops being superconductor and heats up, increases its mixedness by interacting with that environment. What do you think is happening with that environment? The system is getting entangled with the surroundings of the environment. Because you can always describe the whole interaction as, oh, there's a Hamiltonian for the environment, a Hamiltonian for the system, an interaction Hamiltonian between the two. So it's that interaction that is increasing the mixedness. Therefore, the only way, if you have a full picture, all unitary, the only way you can increase the mixedness of the system is by entangling it with the environment. And that's what happens in the coherence. The coherence is entanglement with something else. Make sense? With the environment, really. And we call environment degrees of freedoms, degrees of freedom I have no access to. Questions, comments, debate, yeah. What's up?
I don't believe, but I don't know what to ask.
Why don't you believe it?
Because I think we can have not entangling interaction by having those terms. Like, I can just say that, like...
Again.
I don't know.
No, if you start from the ground state, for example...
I can write a separable state just having that term as well. Like, I can say that, like, the past of A is affecting B, like, you know?
Sorry, this is an interaction. You can start... This is a Hamiltonian, you see?
Yes.
So there's going to be some initial state that I'm going to evolve with the exponential of the Hamiltonian. And what I'm telling you is that if you pick in all the set of initial states that you can think of, the states that will end up not entangled are a zero measure set, are a really small set, infinitely smaller than the set of states that initially separable. So this is rho zero A tensor rho zero B, a product even. It starts as a product. What I'm telling you is that with this Hamiltonian, or generate your favorite Hamiltonian that has some interaction term, then the set of states that won't get entangled under evolution of this is zero measure.
Like, there's a difference between entanglement and decoherency. Like, we can have a phase, but not really entangled.
I'm telling you that there's a theorem that tells you there's not. The theorem tells you that you can think of the coherence always as entanglement with a larger dimensional space. That's a theorem, so there is no discussion, right? That is theorem. If you don't believe it, go see the proof. See what I mean? There's a theorem that tells you that mathematically, you can always find a system that is a larger Hilbert space that you are entangled with. And that is any mixed state, all right? No exceptions. Now, think of the coherence with an environment. I have a system, S, and I have the environment, right? And you say, yeah, the system decoheres. There's some phases that the coherence are killed in the density matrix of the system, for example. But I can tell you, well, the environment is not mysterious. The environment should be describable with quantum mechanics too. Agreed? It's made of molecules. It's made of things that are described by quantum mechanics. Agreed? Unless you believe the environment, there are two classes of systems in the universe, systems and environments. Systems are quantum mechanical. Environments are not. Do you believe that? OK, so we believe that the environment should be quantum mechanical, no? If it's quantum mechanical, I can describe this as there's a Hamiltonian that couples. So there's an environment Hamiltonian, which I don't care about, a system Hamiltonian, which I don't care about necessarily. I might if I want to compute dynamics. And there's also an interaction Hamiltonian between the environment and the system. Agreed? This is unitary evolution. So how can unitary evolution between two parties generate mixedness here? Well, clearly by entangling them. If the interaction is entangling between the system and the environment, then the mixedness of this will increase. And that is the only way.
For example, where does measurement lies in between? Like, I can tell.
Sorry, measurements? There's no measurements here. It's unitary evolution.
Let's say that
this is unitary
evolution. If I want to see this state of S,
that's a different story.
That means that I need to apply a measurement and maybe I'm producing
an How do you apply the measurement with a measurement apparatus? Do you believe that there are two classes of systems in the universe? Quantum systems and quantum environments and measurement apparatuses that quantum mechanics does not apply to your measurement apparatus? Or you think your apparatus is quantum mechanical too? If it's quantum mechanical, then you have the apparatus and there's going to be some interaction. There's going to be the environment Hamiltonian, the system Hamiltonian, the apparatus Hamiltonian. some interaction Hamiltonian between the apparatus, the system, and the environment. Even in the simplification that the environment does not affect your apparatus because you're super careful. This is entangling, by the way. But if you say that I have environment system and then I have apparatus system, sure, it could be the apparatus as the coherence, but that is through entanglement. The apparatus is entangling itself with the system. Okay, but that's all that I'm saying. Make sense? You can always think of mixedness of any kind as entanglement in a larger dimensional system.
But if apparatus is actually producing the entanglement,
yeah.
Entanglement in a higher dimensional system.
Higher dimensional is the dimensions of your system plus the apparatus.
If you don't apply measurement, if you don't have that apparatus, measurement apparatus, then you don't have any entanglement.
Or you do, because you interact with an environment always. There's no lab in the world that doesn't have losses to the environment. So there's always an interaction with the environment, always. You disagree?
No.
Agreed. But that is where's that LOCC coming from? LOCC is coming from getting a system. So LOCC microscopically, if you believe that the operation that you do in the quantum channel you're applying is implemented by systems undergoing quantum mechanics, you can always write a unitary picture. And that's the cool thing. The cool thing is that you can always dilate unitarily your system. Well, with a caveat, but we will see in measurement theory, because we will see the equivalent to Steinspring theorem for POVM. That you can always think of POVMs as unitary evolution, coupled to something else, and PVMs on a system. So we will talk about that when we see measurements. Does that make sense so far? Yes?
Have people tried to derive the Gibbs state from some dynamical?
Yeah, of course, every day. Quantum thermodynamics, one of the biggest objectives that you want. Be able to describe entanglement, thermalization microscopically. Yes, that's one of the big objectives of quantum thermodynamics. And people do it. People start generating random unitaries, assuming that that's what's going to happen with the system with itself, even. It's random partial unitaries that kind of entangle the system with itself so that any subsector of the system looks thermal for the problem of equilibration. That's one way to do it. One way is I have my system. There's going to be a lot of interactions between subparts of my system. My system is huge. This is thermalization without an environment. So you put it in a box, don't let it exchange energy with anything, super idealized. And then what you do is random unitaries that start entangling the system with itself. And there's a scale, you start getting subsystems of that, and they look like the Gibbs state. So that's kind of nice. They look very similar to a Gibbs state. Of course, if you increase the scale, you're going to be losing that. But yeah, people are looking into that indeed. It's one of the open problems in quantum thermodynamics, thermalization. We know a lot, but we don't know all of it. The microscopics of how do you go from a pure state to a mixed state? Yeah. And Steinspring theory is telling you it's all entanglement with something else. Make sense? I like that sound. All right. We are a bit late on topics. Let me introduce the notion of POVM, okay? Because you're going to need it for the tutorial, so it's only fair that we introduce it. And then we can continue discussing, and it's going to get more interesting, I promise. The measurement problem, when we get to it, and we mix it with everything we're talking about, gets really interesting. All right, let me write postulate 4 for quantum mechanics. Measurements of a quantum system . Remember we haven't seen quantum teleportation yet. We have to go back. That is a protocol that uses entanglement as a resource, and I want to see it. It will be fast, but I want to see it, and that belongs to the previous block. So when building notes, maybe you want to put that with the previous block when we see it. I'm only doing that because you need it for the tutorial. So I'm swapping a little bit the topics, but we will go back to that. Measurements of a quantum system. Oh, by the way, what is a measurement? I'm going to call a measurement. I haven't defined it, but a measurement for me is some procedure that I do on a quantum system that returns a number. So it's a map from your quantum system to a number or a set of numbers. It could be numbers with uncertainty, so a set of numbers. Make sense? It's a weird, weird map. I get a probabilistic distribution or a state that represents probabilistic distribution over measurements, even if it's pure. You don't know the outcome of a measurement a priori, but there is a magical map that allows me to do whatever I do, I don't care yet, but it produces a number. Make sense? For example, thermometer is doing that when it's getting you a temperature, acting on a quantum state of the gas, the air in the room, right? If I had a apparatus that measures the electric field and it shows you like 42 volts per meter or something, that is a measurement. You have a quantum state for the field and it's giving you a number in the end. Make sense? That is a measurement. So we're going to try to model that in quantum mechanics, of course, by postulates. All right. So by the way, producing the number, you don't need another postulate. You have Born's rule. That already tells you what the number is. The problem is what happens after measurement, the state update. Because we have observed, people started observing the Stenger-Lach experiment, that sure, you don't know what's going to happen, but the moment you measure once, now you know what's going to happen with that observable. And if you measure in an orthogonal observable, then you don't know what's going to happen in that case. That makes sense. So this is based on things that people observed in nature. And of course, you have to postulate those. Maybe you have a microscopic mechanism, but in principle, the state update needs to be postulated. Do we agree? All right, so let's do it. Measurements of a quantum system are represented by a set. Mn okay of operators on the Hilbert space of the system that satisfy one pair each of the possible of the n total n possible outcomes of the measurement. Doesn't have to be finite, okay? N could be infinite. That satisfies, I'm going to remove the n, so you don't think of finite. That satisfies sum over n, mn dagger, mn is the identity, okay, the index n . So for example, a set of orthogonal projectors would do it, but that's not the only thing. Make sense? The index n refers. You see that if those were projectors, that would do it. If those were projectors, they're self-adjoint, right? And they square to themselves. And if it's a full orthogonal set of projectors, then is a decomposition of the identity. Make sense? But again, not the only set that does it. To first, to the possible outcomes of the measurement. So you have one operator mn per possible outcome of your measurement. All right, so this is objects that I mathematically associate with a particular measurement and all the outcomes of that particular measurement, okay? We'll do an example, and I hope I have time to do the example. And now I'm gonna tell you how to update the state based on the result that you got. That's the postulate, okay? Make sense? If the state of the system is psi, immediately after the measurement, okay, first I'm going to write what's the probability of obtaining. The probability, that is not immediately after the measurement, because the immediately after the measurement is the state, but I'm going to tell you the probability in this language. the probability of obtaining outcome n is p of n equals psi m dagger m psi, and 2, and the state after measurements, after the measurement, is let me just write it here. Psi prime equals m n acting on psi, renormalized to psi m plus to the probability, of course, of having obtained that m psi. We call the operators en, which I define as the positive operators that I define as mn, mn, which of course implies that the sum of all of those is the identity. POVM elements. All right, so here I'm giving you a postulate. So for now, I could tell you very cheekily, just believe, because it's a postulate. Was that the question?
Sorry.
I'm going to tell you in a second. So you know what PVMs are? That's projected value measurements. Those are the first measurements that you see in quantum mechanics when you tell Stenger-Lach experiment, for example, which is you measure your time 7, you project over the eigenvalue 7, over the state of eigenvalue 7. Make sense? That's what you've been doing in quantum mechanics since you were kids. Some, you know what I mean by that. Maybe some of you have seen this is the adult version if you want. Oh, it's clearly a generalization of this, right? Because I can take my M's to be projectors, right? If they are projectors, this is literally the PVM update rule. Agreed? If they are the eigenprojectors associated with the nth eigenvalue of the observable I'm measuring, then certainly these are projective measurements. But it generalizes them because I allow this not to be projectors. And instead, I have certain freedom picking those, right? Because you can see there's a unitary freedom, right? If I define these M's modulo unitary, the E will be the same. These are E's are called POVM elements because POVMs are positive operator valued measurements. I introduced these are the positive operators that the name refers to. Make sense? So it's a postulate that generalizes the projection postulate, if you want, of state updates. Make sense? And it allows, so I'm going to claim that this allows for all possible experimental procedures that you can think of. This, in general, okay, where is this? This, in general, this includes projective measurements, but is not limited to projective measurements. Now, of course, if you had a density operator, you know how it updates, right? Because if this is the way to update the ket, you know how to update the ket bra. Right? The same way that you apply the projector to rho and renormalize, it's the same thing. You substitute here by the trace of the new state, and here you apply the m to both sides, m and n dagger. Make sense? Or E to the density operator. Make sense? Now, why do we need this generalization? I don't know if I have time for an example. Maybe I should do an example. It's kind of weird because I really want you to have the material to do it, but we are not discussing why we need the generalization yet. It's a matter of time, having time. Let me give you an example first, and then we can discuss why we need it. How about that? Because I think you need this, or it'd be helpful to have this for the tutorial. Right, I'll give you an example. Can you distinguish between the state psi 1, which is say 0, and the state psi 2, which is 1 root 2, 0 plus 1, in a single shot measurement? And then I'm going to do it with PBMs. And an example with a POBM. So with PBMs, say that you measure sigma z, for example. Can you distinguish, it doesn't matter which observable you measure, to be honest, but can you distinguish these two states? The answer is with PBMs, well, definitely not. Let's see what happens if we measure sigma z. Probability of 0 if we measure sigma z on psi 1 is, of course, Bohn's rule, right? Psi 1, 0 is 1. Probability of 0 measuring psi 2, 0, is 1 half. Probability of 0 measuring psi 1 is 1 half. Probability of 1, psi 2, sorry, measuring psi 2 is 1 half on a single copy. Agreed, everybody?
No.
No?
What do you have three
psi 2? Oh. Psi 1, psi 2, sorry, I'm just copying the, this is probability of 1 on psi 1. And this is probability of 0 on psi 1. No, probability of 0, okay, I just want to write the whole matrix. Probability of 0 on psi 1 is 1, that we agree. Probability of 1 on psi 1 is 0, my bad. Probability of 0 on psi 2 is 1 half, probability of 1 on psi 2 is 1 half. Now we're fine, thank you. All right, so here clearly you have a problem distinguishing them, right? Because of course, if you measure, it's true that if you measure the value 1, you know that you have psi 2. But if you measure the value 0, you don't know. It could be either of them. Make sense? So in this method, there's no method there's no outcome of the measurement. So the two possible valid outcomes of the measurement, 0 and 1, cannot distinguish the two. Make sense? Let's do an alternative with a POBM. With a POBM. I'm going to give you the following POBM. E1 is root 2, 1 plus root 2, 1, 1. E2 is root 2, 1 plus root 2, 0 minus 1, 0 minus 1. Divided by 2. And E3 is that. So imagine that you have a lab that is doing an experiment that there are three possible outcomes, right? You're given a state and the lab has a little light that lights up, light number one. Sometimes light number two lights up, and sometimes you have both light up, or none, or something else. See what I mean? There are two possible outcomes and a negative outcome. Your experiment failed. Your experiment is inconclusive. You get a dark count, a result that you don't like. Make sense? I'm allowing for it. And the measurement in the lab is modeled by this POBM. OK? One question you can ask is, how do you find a POBM if you have an experiment in a lab? You can do tomography of your experiment. You have a bunch of states and see what they do to them and build up by reverting that map, right? By having all the times. So you can always find the POBMs or a set of POBMs associated with your experiment. And somebody in a lab is doing this. It's given states, right? Given states of a qubit that you input, there are three possible outcomes and they're described by these three POBM elements. Let's call this one outcome one, outcome two, and let's call this one negative outcome, like inconclusive, for example. Make sense? If I do that, and this is how I end, probability on, let's see, from psi 1 of getting the outcome 1 is psi 1 E1 psi 1 is 0. Probability on psi 1 obtaining the outcome 2 is, of course, psi 1 E2 psi 1. It's going to be 1, well, it's 1 half root 2, 1 plus root 2, which is equal to 1 minus 1 over root 2. Probability of psi 3 is psi 1 E3 psi 1, and the result is 1 over root 2, obviously.
Probably psi 1, 3.
Ah, thank you. All right, and then we do the same with state 2. Probability of psi 2 obtaining 1 is, again, psi 2 E1 psi 2. And we get 1 minus 1 root 2. Probability on psi 2 obtaining 2 is psi 2 E2 psi 2, which is 0. Probability of psi 3 psi 2 obtaining 3 is psi 2 E3 psi 3. And this is 1 over root 2. Of course, the probability of getting any outcome has to sum up to 1, and that's why the E's have to sum up to identity, and that's what we have here. So we have your two possible meaningful outcomes of the experiment and the probability that the experiment fails doesn't give any of the outcomes. Makes sense? An inconclusive result. Now let's look at the difference here. If you obtain the outcome 0, in this case, you cannot really tell which one you have. And the probability of failing is 1 half. 1 half of the time, you will be failing. The probability, if you obtain the outcome 1, then sure, you can distinguish the two. Let's compare with this scenario. With this scenario, if I obtain the outcome 1, I always know that I have psi 2. Agreed? If I obtain the outcome 2, I always know that I have psi 1. And there's a third result. The experiment will tell me, oh, it's inconclusive. So you see, the outcome 1 and 2, none of them are inconclusive, unlike this one. But of course, you have to pay a price. The price is that you can have inconclusive outcomes. The experiment will tell you I'm inconclusive. But you see, the probability of failing is lower than with that. The probability of failing here is 1 half. If you do PVMs, you're going to have a 1 half probability of failure, always. If you do it with a POVM, you can design it to have 1 over root 2 probability of failure. And it's even better, because there's two clear distinguishing scenarios here, where here, there's only one clear distinguishing scenario. See what I mean? You obtain outcome 1, you know it's 2. If you obtain outcome 2, you know it's 1. And if you obtain the third one, well, it's inconclusive, but the probability of that is lower than the probability of inconclusive experiments here. Make sense, everybody? This is just an example. And I feel sad a little bit that we haven't discussed what we need this to begin with. But at least you have all the tools now to do the assignment. I promise to you that Friday, we will discuss the measurement problem, why we need POVMs, the equivalent to the dilation theorem for POVMs. So how can we understand POVMs as somehow interactions between detectors and systems? Because PVMs have these horrible features. You know, when you studied measurement theory in basic quantum mechanics, you have to face one horrible reality, which is the universe has two kinds of states, two of systems, quantum systems and measurement apparatuses. And the measurement apparatuses don't obey the laws of quantum mechanics, because the interaction between the system and the apparatus is a projection, and that is not coming from a Hamiltonian evolution. Make sense? POVMs are going to be better. For now, I haven't justified. It's just a mathematical definition via postulate. I'm telling you, in the lab, I can certainly build things that are non-projective. Okay, that's what I'm saying. And in the lab, I'm telling you that everything that I can build in the lab can be written as a POVM, which kind of makes sense, because all that I'm saying is I obtain classical values. You see, this is the natural way of doing it. And I obtain some values, some number. I associate some update operator with it number. And of course, the sum of obtaining all possible number has to be identity. Makes sense? That's all that I'm saying with this definition. And if I'm clever in a lab, I may be able to design a protocol to measure non-orthogonal states that is better than measuring observables with projective measurements. You see, this method is certainly better in two ways. The probability of failure is less, and you never have failure, you have a definite outcome, one or two. Make sense?
Is it possible for E1?
1/√2 is larger than half.
Yeah, I agree, but the thing is, you have to count the probability in different ways. So it's not the one root two only. It's the probability of getting a right result, if you want. You have to consider the probability of distinguishing fully multiplied by the probability of getting that result. Okay, we count the probability next day. So you're obtaining conclusive 1/√2 of the time, I agree. But you know that if you obtain a value, you always get a value. You always get a result. You always distinguish the two. So when the outcome, the experiment is giving you a valid value, it's not lying to you. But we can count probabilities tomorrow, because it's going to be something like 1/√2 probability of success multiplied by the probability of being in one state or the other. So it gets a 1/2 multiplying the 1/√2 for this one. Make sense? But again, we'll see next day. You can erase the board. Sorry. Yeah. More questions about this? Oh yeah, please come to Friday. Come in person if you can. That's for people online.
Is it possible to find an E1, E2, where they sum to 1 and there is no E3, and also have all of this?
What's that?
Is it possible to find an E1 and E2 that sum to 1 without an E3?
You can, but then you won't be able to distinguish clearly the two cases, which is what we want.
Is it just that? That's the only case that E1. Is it PVMs? So if you find E1 and E2, the sum to 1 is always has to
in this case, yes, because there are two possible outcomes. So you need projection over outcome 1,
right.
Projection over outcome 2 to have a... Because the outcomes are orthogonal, right? Is there 0 or 1 for the state? Because the outcomes are orthogonal, they need to adapt to 1. And there's only 2, yes. It's going to be projectors.
But is there any possibility that the first 2 don't add up to 1, but the third one... The probability goes to epsilon.
Yeah, you can do that. Yeah, but eventually, when epsilon goes to 0, those are projections. Anyway, this is just a basic example, but you can see this is very rich. You can actually reduce this number a lot. The technique to reduce the number a lot is include 4, 5, 6, 7 that are giving you still distinguishable. For example, with all the odd ones, you get that is a state 1. With all the even ones, it's state 2. You can build them like that.
Why isn't that the probability? You're saying the 1/√2 is not the probability.
It is. It's the probability of getting an inconclusive result here.
Yeah, but the probability there was 1/2.
Not really, because there you have the way to count it. There you have two possible outcomes, 1 or 0.
Right.
With outcome 1, you can never tell what state it is. Here, you have one individual outcome that tells you exactly what it is. You didn't have that there. So there, you either get a state 0 or you don't know. Here, if you get state 0, state 1, or you don't know.
Yeah.
So the probability depends on with what probability you generate one state or the other. If the probability of getting one or the other is 1/2, you have to multiply by 1/2. Whereas here, you don't.